Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and I'm, of course, joined by my partner in crime, Frank. What's going on, Frank?
How's it going?
Doing good, doing good. I know you're excited as well as I am. We're very lucky to have the terrific filmmaker Lynn Shelton on our show today. And as my old saying goes, if you're not familiar, well, then shame on you, because for close to a decade, she's been making some of the most unique and funny and touching independent films that have gotten released. Some of her work includes Hump Day, Your Sister's Sister, and her most recent effort was Laggies, which came out last year with Keira Knightley and Sam Rockwell and Chloe Grace Moretz. And she's been one of my favorite filmmakers over the last 6-7 years. And she's a filmmaker who's always been interested in people and emotions and the complexities of the human heart and mind. And we are extremely delighted to chat with her today about her career and for her love of cinema. Thanks for coming on the show, Lynn. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
Anytime. This is incredible. Like I told you the other day, or when was it? Yesterday. Touchy-feely, I still all day thought about that movie. All day today, and I absolutely loved it. And thank you so much for making that. That movie is fantastic.
Well, as I mentioned to you, Frank, I feel like that is that's a film that's really close to my heart. It's a super personal film to me, and it was one that I kind of had no choice. Like, I had to make it. It just, even though I knew it wasn't going to be a big commercial success by any means, you know, because of the territory I wanted to explore with it. But I had to get it out of me, and the experience of making it was unbelievably, was terrifying because it was such a personal film, and it made me feel so vulnerable from the very beginning of making it to the end. But I had this, because of that, it was a very bonding experience. The entire cast and crew, I think, all, you know, felt really deeply as we were making it and got really connected to each other. And so it's a film that means a lot to me, and I love it. And when somebody else connects to it, it just means the world, because it isn't my most accessible or mainstream, you know, popular of the films I've made. And so it means an extra amount when somebody, you know, kind of like says, hey, this one film really speaks to me. So thanks, Frank.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime. Because I looked on Rotten Tomatoes and the IMDb user score for it, and like, I was upset.
Yeah.
When I was looking at it, I was like, "Well, I don't understand what the fuck's wrong with everybody who saw this movie that's trying to give it somewhat of a negative rating." I mean, I'll gush about it later. I know Nick wants to chime in here, but yeah, I just want to say real quick, thank you for making that movie. That film's fantastic. So I'll turn it over to Nick real quick.
No, and we'll definitely come back to Touchy Feely, because that's it's easily your most unique film in the whole, you know, span of your filmography, definitely. And I'm not surprised that both Frank and I responded to it, you know, maybe more so than others, because, you know, from what I've learned about Frank's tastes in film, we both sort of like the more challenging stuff and the stuff that doesn't necessarily hold your hand, you know, while you're telling the story. And I guess that's sort of what I wanted to maybe just start off with, is your career is so interesting because you've made six movies over just under 10 years. So you've kept very busy. And I'd sort of be curious to know where your style and where your sensibilities came from, and sort of how you got your start with making films. I do believe you have some sort of acting background. Is that correct?
I do. I was a very long, circuitous route for me to get to become a narrative filmmaker. I always knew I was going to be an artist. Like, I felt really early on, I was like dictating poems to my mom before I could even actually write them down myself. And really early on, I was, you know, painting and taking photographs and started taking acting classes when I was about 11. And then kind of narrowed it down. By the time I got to to college, I decided to really concentrate on acting. And it was for the theater. It was purely for the theater. There wasn't really any acting for camera classes, or I didn't have access to that at the University of Washington in Seattle, where I was, which is where I was raised. And so I was really concentrating on the theater. And it was funny because I was always being told, I was getting cast a lot, and it was great, and I really felt like I was good at it and was being told that I was. But people would tell me, you know, you should act for the camera because your performances are honest and believable, but they're a little too small for the stage, you know. They're a little too nuanced, a little too small, you know, and subtle. And then I had to really learn how to convey, how to keep the seed of emotional truth, and then convey it to the back row of the theater. You know, it's a skill, you know, and it's very different. Acting for the theater on the stage is really, really different than acting on film. And some people can go back and forth between it seamlessly, but some people can't, you know, they really are better suited for one or the other. At any rate, all that to say, I ended up moving to New York, right after, like a year after graduation, to work in the theater. And as soon as I tried to make a living at it, I kind of, theater and I sort of had a falling out, you know, it was just too rough. And I ended up turning to photography, which had always remained a kind of secondary love, you know, sort of in the background, but I really got deeply into it and ended up going to graduate school, the School of Visual Arts, which luckily for me was not a super stringent, you know, that's all about the fine black and white print or whatever, because this is right when digital photography was super new. So we were still mostly spending all our days in the dark room, you know, huffing the chemicals, which was awesome. And I went in doing these, like I was making very documentary style, sort of Robert Frank style, Helen Levitt kind of, Vivian Maier, actually, just, you know, recently was introduced to the great Vivian Maier and fell, and she's now my favorite photographer. That was the kind of stuff I was doing when I went in. But when I came out, I was an experimental filmmaker, and my marketable skill was editing, digital editing, which was new at the time. And so I started, I taught part-time for a few years there and was just making my own handcrafted, I was sort of in between experimental filmmaking and video artist. So sometimes I would show in a gallery and sometimes I would show in an experimental film festival, but it was like pure self-expression. You know, I made a dozen little movies. Some of them are sort of experimental documentaries, first-person cinema films, you know. I made a 54 minute film about the relationship between women and their body hair. And, I saw there was a New York Times article today about women dyeing their armpit hair different colors. And it made me so happy. I can't even tell you.
You've come full circle with the body hair.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I was making all kinds I really wasn't thinking about an audience at all. I was just exploring, you know, my aesthetic. But what I knew was I loved film. I could never go back to photography. I could never go back to anything else because it was just so I loved how it engaged all of your senses. There's this great book called Sculpting in Time by Andrei Tarkovsky, where he says that it was sort of a shame that as soon as film came around, they used the structure of plays, of theater, to kind of, you know, narrative film became based on the theater experience and playwriting. And he said that was all wrong because the closest medium to film is actually poetry. And the way that it can, you know, sort of create such an all-consuming environment where it's the closest medium, art medium we have to the human experience, to actually replicating the human experience between the sound design and the visuals, and then all the different ways that you can, you know, all the cinematic languages combined create this, you know, you can actually get people to experience what a person, you know, you can do this subjective filmmaking kind of stuff. Anyway, he was saying that, and that was sort of, I took that to heart, you know, that poetry is actually the closest it's more akin to poetry, what you can do and how you can make people actually viscerally feel something by putting something on the screen. So I was kind of exploring all the different ways that you could do that. And I would like shoot on Super 8 film and then blacked out my bathroom and cracked open the little canister with a hammer and then hand developed the stuff. And, you know, I was just doing crazy, crazy stuff. And then eventually, and then became an editor. I moved back to Seattle after about 10 years in New York. And became this go-to editor because it was I was a bigger fish in a smaller pond, I guess. So I got opportunities to edit narrative, other people's narrative films. And that was when I realized, oh, I think I'm finally ready. Now that I've acted for a few years, I've, you know, explored photography. I know editing, you know, is sort of has taught me how to tell stories cinematically. I'm ready to actually start. And so I was 39 when I wrote and directed We Go Way Back, my first feature. And it was all because I was basically commissioned by this nonprofit, very short-lived visionary nonprofit film studio in Seattle called The Film Company, invited me to write and direct my first feature film. It was ridiculously ridiculous good fortune. I was really, really blessed that I had that opportunity. And then yeah, that was my first time really on a set because I'd been on the post side of things, but I'd never actually worked with the team of people that you need to make a big feature film. And then after that, after having been a control freak as an artist and been a real solo artist for many years, it suddenly all became about relationship for me. Art making became all about collaboration and relationship. I knew I was never going to make a work of art alone again. And my life was changed forever. And I knew, this is what I was always meant to do. It took me a while to get here, but, you know, and I don't think I could have done it before, which is the other interesting thing, you know, because I sort of needed the wisdom and maturity and confidence that the years gave me, you know, of living on the earth. And I all of the skill sets that I learned before. So it was like a very long, protracted film school.
That's so interesting because when I was watching your films, I think at the common core of them is when I watched them, they don't feel like they take place in movie world. They feel like they take place in the real world and the real people with real relationships that are incredibly dimensional. And I can't help but think from everything you just told us about your essentially long road to becoming a filmmaker, that's what that would be akin to.
Yeah, it was nice. It was also nice to start making movies out of Los Angeles and New York. I mean, there was nobody ever kind of telling me, oh, this is the way to do it, you know?
Right.
And so I was always kind of an outsider in a way. And I think that was helpful for me because I was able to kind of take this weird back road or whatever, you know, to get there. I don't know. Film school might've been awesome. I might've had a great time there and felt completely inspired and it would have, you know, might've been great. But,
it sounds like you gave yourself film school without needing to waste the money. And, you know, there's nothing better than hands on experience and learning at that level. And one of the things that, to sort of get back to what Frank was saying about how your films don't exist in, you know, movie world, which I totally agree. There's a wonderful naturalistic feeling to everything. And one of the things that I've noticed throughout the work is that all of your movies have, you know, taken place in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest. And that area is clearly a character for you thematically and visually throughout, many of your films. My Effortless Brilliance, really interesting film in the sense that it spoke about the artistic process at times, and yet it felt very insular to these two people. How important is it for you to keep your work set in Seattle, and how much do you strive to make that sort of a character in your stuff?
Well, you know, Seattle and this whole region, I mean, some of the, you know, your sister is a little bit in Seattle, but mostly up in one of the San Juan Islands, which is actually a few hours away, and Effortless Brilliance the same. It's across the mountains you know, about 5 hours outside of Seattle, but in Washington State and in these regions that I've grown up knowing and coming to know, it's in my bones. And so it's, and I have an incredibly deep love and loyalty for this region. And we're, you know, I live here. And, so I often travel to do work to pay the rent, doing, you know, episodic TV work, for instance, in New York or LA, but I never want to move if I can help it. You know, I want to be here forever. And so I do have this, deep affinity for the place and want to make my work here just because I love it so much. But it also, because I know it so well, it makes it a lot easier for me as I'm writing and as I'm visualizing a story. I know these neighborhoods within Seattle. I know these regions in the state. And so I'm able to actually, you know, when I'm sitting down pen to paper, it's a lot easier for me to just kind of visualize exactly where this character lives and where this particular kind of scene would take place and where, you know what I mean? And so it's a little bit laziness on my part because, you know, because I do feel like a sense of place. It's so incredibly, for me, it resonates. It tells so much about character, right? It tells so much about, you can convey so much narrative content just in the setting. If it's specific, you know, I really have a hard time with anything on screen that is just kind of in a homogenous place and you don't really know where it is. It's just kind of this generic, you know, sense of place. It's so much more interesting to me when you are really, you know, you got the foundation of a very clear setting, you know. And also growing up, you know, it's also a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. It was always exciting to see your hometown on the screen. So let's say, Say Anything, right? Or Sleepless in Seattle. So in Say Anything, for instance, there's this, it's set in Seattle, it's shot in Seattle. Fantastic. But there are these sections that don't make any geographic sense if you are a local. So John Cusack is running down the street, you know, and there are like 10 shots of him. Every single shot, it's supposed to be a continuous run, you know, from one point A to point B. But he's in like, you know, completely different neighborhoods.
Right.
You know, all around the city. And they just shot stuff that looked good. And, you know, that's the classic outsider director or producer coming to a town and saying, well, let's just, you know, we're shooting here, but let's just make whatever's convenient or looks pretty or whatever. And so that's something that a local will never see in my movies, you know, and it's just my own personal satisfaction. If Keira Knightley is starting out at the Chihuly Glass Museum at the Seattle Center, she's going to go across the Ballard Bridge to get up to the Crown Hill grocery store outlet. I mean, it's crazy. Like everything is geographically specific when at all possible in my movie, you know, and so in all my movies. And so there is this kind of a almost defiant sense of, I want this to be the locals' version, you know, for my own personal satisfaction. I want locals to be able to see this and just really feel like, oh yeah, that person is actually in that place. But yeah, it is, I mean, I really admire John Sayles, for instance, because he goes to a new region and he'll totally get to know it, admire himself in it, and then write for that place. And that is a rare thing. And it's rare that, you know, somebody actually is willing to put that kind of investment in. And for me, I'm such a homebody. Like I would rather just stay here and write for the region I already know and love, you know. I don't have the same adventurous spirit. That's not to say that I wouldn't do that. And I do, and I know that someday I'll either A, be forced to shoot something somewhere because we won't be able to, you know, the producers won't be able to make the incentive program of our state work, you know, it's a too high budget or something. Or also, you know, there's regions that I have visited that I love. I have this fantasy that I'm going to shoot a film in Ireland someday because I've had some really beautiful experiences there. And, you know, I mean, I know it'll happen someday, but I would love to make the bulk of my, you know, many, many more movies in Washington State for sure.
Do you see yourself, do you see yourself maybe making an LA movie? And maybe the question is more, you seem to make movies for yourself in a way. And I say that in a very good way, the movies that you make seem like they needed to be made, like you wanted to make them. No one has been, you know, there's nothing here for hire. Do you want to, because with Laggies, you know, I want to definitely talk about the rest of your work, but Laggies is the biggest movie in terms of like star wattage and star power. And it seemed, and if you look at your films and as a progression, they all feel like a natural progression in terms of getting bigger and having more polish and having more of a, you know, just feeling more like the Hollywood norm while still not being the Hollywood norm, which is why I love your work. What are the temptations of taking a meeting with Judd Apatow and, you know, doing something like that versus just trying to make the movies for yourself?
Well, you know, Laggies was, my first multi-million, you know, over $1 million movie. And it was also the first time I ever was directing somebody else's script. And I didn't just, you know, take the script as was and make it. But when I read Andrew Siegel's script, it really spoke to me. So I've had it ever since Hump Day, which was my first film that got into Sundance. And I got some attention and so I got representation. And ever since I've had an agent, I've been reading scripts. People have sent me scripts. I've been asked to pitch for, you know, for jobs and things. And so I've read a lot of other people's scripts, and really good ones, you know, not crappy ones. But like, you know, I've been lucky enough to read a lot of really good scripts, but it's very
rare. Because this is the only thing that you haven't written.
Yeah, exactly. It's very rare that I feel like you're absolutely right. I don't want to make a movie unless I feel completely passionately that I have to make this movie, that I'm the right director for it, and that there's a real personal, passionate connection to the content on some level, you know. And that's what I felt as soon as I read Laggies. I thought, well, I felt like, well, I didn't write this, but I definitely could have. And I had actually wanted to go back to a similar kind of territory that I had explored with my first film. I feel like there's a kinship between my very first film and Laggies, because I was exploring somebody who is sort of lost in their 20s, a little at sea, and has this relationship with a younger version of themselves in a way. And at one point, you know, in We Go Way Back, my first film, there actually is a real physical manifestation, psychic/physical manifestation of an earlier, the character, main character's earlier self. But
you should talk about
that. But yeah, and at one point when I was writing that and trying to develop the idea, there was a version of it that she was going to be a proxy. You know, the younger version of the self wasn't going to be the actual character at 13 years old. She was going to be like some kid that the main character meets or befriends or has to house or something. And so it was crazy to read. I wanted to kind of go back to that territory. And here I read Laggies and it was like, oh my God, it's like, this was what I might've written, you know, years before in 2004 when I wrote that. So it was really, I just immediately felt, and there were a lot of other things about it that I felt a real kinship to, not least of which was, one of the things was that her voice. I felt like the writer and I had a real affinity for humor coming out of a very character-based place as opposed to, you know, sort of more contrived, pratfall-y, broad humor. You know, it was really, it came from an extremely kind of flip side of the drama. So anyway, that was a new experience and something I wanted to try out. You know, let's try working with a few million dollars and having more toys and bells and whistles for my crew and working with, yeah, a kind of a more star powery cast and just, working on a slightly different level, a more expanded level. And it's not something that I'm at all averse to, you know, even working on a super, super big level. I used to just say flatly, no, I would never do a studio film. I would never do Transformers 6 or whatever. But that's not necessarily true. You know, if I had the right producer or the right star or somebody who I knew would be on my team, you know, to advocate with me and for me, when we were working on a, you know, on a creative level. I feel like I'd be open to that as well, as long as the project meant something deeply to me. I would never just do, what I wouldn't do is just be a gun for hire and just do a script like for the money or whatever. You know, I would never do that. It's just too much. Life is too damn short. It's yep. too hard and it takes too much time to make a film. I would not want to waste that kind of effort and energy on a project that I didn't feel really deeply passionately about, you know?
Yeah, speaking of projects you are deeply passionate about, I wanted to move to Touchy Feely because I've been waiting the whole time to talk to you about this. So, you know, while watching this film, it was very striking to me personally because out of all the main characters, I could identify with each one of their plights in the film because I have been, you know, essentially in each one of their shoes at one point in my life, and it was very reflective, and I can't help but maybe think that that's why it's a polarizing film, to draw, like, contrast to I Melt With You, which, I mean, Touchy Feely isn't nearly as extreme as Pellington's film in regards to the reflective nature of the film, but I truly felt that. I mean, Ellen Page's character and Rosemary DeWitt and Scoot McNairy's character, I mean, of course, and I don't want to get too far off track with everything I'm going to talk about with this, but, you know, I was watching the film, and then towards the end of it, you have, like, with the Rosemary DeWitt and the Ron Livingston scene where they're inside of his grandmother's home, it's so Malick-y. It was just incredible watching it. It was so heartfelt and it, maybe for lack of a better word, spiritual, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost indescribable how I felt while watching that. I mean, that it's just so incredible.
Wow. Thanks so much, Frank. That's what I was going for sure.
You know, awesome.
Yeah, it makes me really, really, really happy to hear that. And that's interesting you should say that. I mean, one of the things I wanted to allow myself when I was making that film was mystery, you know, because
yes.
I feel like I definitely am more in the camp of not wanting to, you know, take the audience by the hand and, you know, let's just be really have everything kind of overdrawn and overwritten and spell it all out because that's not what life is, you know. It was interesting, Rosemarie and I, it was really hard for Rosemarie to make that film, I think. She was so sweet after Your Sister, I said, I have this idea, I have this role for you. I really want to do another project with you. And she didn't, she just said yes without even hearing, you know, I barely told her anything about it. She just really wanted to work with me again. And I was really grateful for that. But it was such a different experience for her because she's going through this, her character is going through this real depression and a feeling of just, of really not knowing what the hell is going on. And so she is somebody who really, as an actor, who really wants to understand what is happening and what are the sort of broader, you know, what's really going on and be, so she's sort of a dramaturg. She has an amazing mind and is just incredibly intelligent. And I, you know, I sort of said, honey, like, I'm sorry, but you know, this character is in a place of really not knowing. And it was terrifying for her. It was really, really hard and difficult for her emotionally. And she just dove in as she always does because she's such a pro and she's such a passionate, engaged artist. But it's an uncomfortable place. It was uncomfortable for her. It's uncomfortable for the audience, I think.
You asked a lot of her in that role. And I know we talked about it offline, but when I saw the film, I was immediately struck by the similarities thematically to Todd Haynes's movie Safe with Julianne Moore,
yeah,
about this person that is just psychologically revolted by all that's around her for not the most clear-cut reason. And one of the things, and to, you know, to sort of get what both you and Frank were talking about with the reaction to touchy-feely, when somebody makes a film that sort of picks at the scab of emotional turbulence, there's not a lot of people that really want to do that all the time. They want to go to their movies and have their popcorn and watch something nice and easy and digestible. And, you know, when you make a film about a masseuse who can no longer look at skin because she's so upset about it for whatever reason, and you have to learn what that reason is without having to be told so specifically, I think it can be a sort of a bother to some people. You're a fan of Safe, I presume?
I love that movie. It is definitely on my list of top, the top, I don't know, it's hard to make a list of your favorite films, but it's right up there, man. I love that movie. I mean, I have to say that comparatively, I don't feel like I was nearly as brave as he was. I remember walking out of the Angelika Theater in New York City and not knowing what the hell I was supposed to be feeling. That's what I remember. And I remember just thrumming, like, you know, viscerally thrumming with, like, holy shit, what did I just see? I don't know. I have no idea who I'm supposed to be rooting for, or what, you know, what I'm supposed to think is going to happen next. And I mean, it was just, it really had a huge effect on me, for sure. I wasn't really thinking about that movie when I was making Touchy Feely, but when, as soon as you drew that relationship, I realized there's definitely a relationship, because mystery is what that movie is. It's complete mystery.
Yeah. It's the ultimate emotional mystery movie that, and just to maybe just throw some context for people, because it is sort of an under the radar movie. Todd Haynes is a fantastic filmmaker, but unfortunately he's not a household name the way that he should be, in my opinion. Safe is a film that came out, was it 93 or 94? I think 95.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in the early mid 90s, and it's Julianne Moore is a suburban, you know, housewife, and all of a sudden one day she's unable to live her life normally anymore because everything is bothering her on an emotional and psychological level. And the film is a deeply layered exploration of what it's like to have a crisis of conscience and emotional and spiritual breakdown. And that your movies are always about characters in transition. They're always about characters in flux, people finding themselves. And I know Frank and I have talked about this. We can't help but feel that you sort of were at the forefront of the bromance type, you know, narrative between My Effortless Brilliance and then obviously Hump Day. You know, the Apatow explosion of male characters opening up to each other and to those around them really took off in the mid 2000s and now, and you sort of just seem to be right there without ever actually taking that more commercial step. What was it like to get Hump Day made and released in the sense that you really sort of did kick off that bromance thing with that movie?
Yeah, I don't know if I kicked it off, but I sort of, it was definitely my take, I guess. Somebody said once, it's like you took the bromance and then just pushed it all the way through to the other side or something, like you took it far.
Yeah.
Somehow took it as far as it could go. Maybe farther than it should have gone. I don't know. But yeah, the thing that was beautiful about that movie was just to backtrack a tiny bit. My very first film was completely scripted. I made it in a traditional way, the way that I, you know, been told that movies were made. And I sat down and wrote a script and I tried to find actors who could fit these roles. And, you know, it was this nonprofit film studio. So there wasn't a lot of money, but there were a lot of volunteers, a lot of people really excited. So I had a big crew. We were working with 35 millimeter film, on a super loud, gigantic camera that was sort of donated to us practically. And so all these actors who were theater actors mostly, and some very young and some very, you know, untested, were great in the sort of intimacy of a audition set setting. But once we got on set, it was such a crazy, you know, like, wow, this is what actors have to contend with. I mean, that's what it was like for me. I couldn't believe all of the mayhem and the smoke machines and all the stuff going, you know, people running around to make it look good. And then the actors had to, like, you know, be perform on demand, and it was just really tough. So I wanted to try just completely turning that inside out and taking a page from Dogma 95 and just saying, okay, we're going to be flies on the wall with in doc style and little tiny digital cameras and no lights and just make it really performance centered for my second film. It was like an experiment. I didn't even know if it would be possible to make a movie that way, but I just wanted to do an experiment and see. And then base the characters on the actors and have them build the characters with me. So it just would fit them like a glove, you know, fit their own characters. The characters would fit them like a glove and improvise all of the dialogue further, you know, more to make it just really be as naturalistic as possible. So I made Effortless Brilliance. I got into South by Southwest. I sold it to IFC. I couldn't believe they wanted to buy it. I was floored. And so my next movie, I was like, okay, I know I can work in this way. I came to Mark Duplass, who I wanted to work with, and said, I want to make a movie. He said, you know, with you, he said, just pitch me something, you know, I'm ready to go. And it took me a few days once I came up with this idea, because I was really worried he would say no. And and the funny thing is, when I pitched it to him, I saw him as the nomadic, crazy artist guy. And he immediately said, no, I got to be the domesticated dude. And then he came up with the idea of Josh Leonard, and it was really mean because he called Josh and said, dude, you want to make a movie together, you know, a couple weeks of shooting in Seattle. And immediately Josh just said yes before he knew what it was. And he said, okay, well, the director's going to pitch you the idea or tell you what the idea is after he'd already said yes. So these guys were really, the thing that is that Josh and Mark, neither of them believed, really truly believed that this would be possible to make this movie believably. You know, they were really like, we're not going to be able to pull this off, but we're going to put ourselves into it 110% trying, you know, none of us wanted to make it unless we could make it believable, unless we could really, you know, just make it believable. And the thing that was so beautiful about it was that it was the smallest group of people. It was like all together. I think there were 8 or 10 of us working on the cast and crew of the whole thing. It cost very little money because I wrote it specifically to be cheap. And then I borrowed, you know, a dear friend just gave me his house for a couple of weeks, and we shot it mostly in this one house. And then the other locations were all donated. And I knew I was going to be able to sell it. I just knew I was going to be able to sell it for something. So everybody got something up front, you know, who worked on it. But then they all got back end, you know, everybody who worked on it, the crew and everybody. So, anyway, it was made so cheaply that if we'd failed, we could have just swept it under the rug. Nobody needed to be the wiser. You know, we could just take this complete and creative risk without, you know, being worried about burning some investor or, you know, like ruining our careers. Like, we didn't have to worry about it because it was so off the radar when we were making it. And that's the beautiful thing about independent film. Like, that is the sort of, right there is the reason for it to exist, you know, and for micro budget cinema to exist, for, you know, to take that even further. And it's such a great thing that I'm so excited. I just saw a preview for Tangerine. I'm so excited to see it, this movie that was shot on iPhones. And I don't know anything about how much its budget was. You know about this movie, right? Do you guys know about this movie?
Yeah, I just saw something about it today.
And it just got me all excited because it reminded me of Hump Day, you know, and the spirit, you know, in which we make. And I don't know anything about this movie, but all I know is shot on iPhones. And when I saw the preview, I was like, that is an independent movie. You know, that is the true. No studio would have, you know, backed that. And so anyway, to actually have it make a little bit of a splash at Sundance, I mean, it had so much love there. I felt like we were the Cinderella at the ball or something. It was crazy. And to be in narrative competition and get a special jury prize and then to just so much. Yeah, there's just still.
It's a bold movie, so it deserves.
Well, it was really nice that people felt that way. And still do, very sweetly. And so, yeah, it was huge. It changed my life, that movie, for sure.
Yeah, I love Duplass in that. I'm a big fan. So is Nick. We're both big fans of Togetherness. We love that show. Mm. And I loved him in your sister's sister. I mean, I love that. I love the whole film, but I think he's such a unique actor.
Mm, yes.
And he brings a lot to everything that I've seen him in, and particularly your films. And right after I got done watching Your Sister's Sister, I could be way off here, but the first thing I thought of, I sent Nick a message right after I got done watching it, and I said, a mini version of The Big Chill, question mark. And I mean, that's kind of what I gathered from it. I mean, on a much smaller scale, because you're dealing with three characters and stuff like that. But what really led me to believe that was, you know, Duplass is at a stage in his life, the death of his brother, mm-hmm. and he kind of reaches like the big chill, or like the big realization of midlife.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true. We always talked about how, especially, I don't know if we talked about this, I guess we talked about it on set a little bit, but my editor, Nat Sanders, and I really realized it in the edit room that there's really four characters, because that brother, the dead brother, who you only see in pictures at the very beginning of the movie, and they don't even really talk about him directly that much in the film, but he's always
right.
present, you know. He becomes a real factor in this crazy triangle of a relation, you know, all these relationships, and his ghost is there throughout the film. So it's definitely has that, and combined with, you're right, Nick, you pointed out earlier that my films all are about people at some moment of flux or crisis, or some sort of identity crisis, some moment of sort of you know,
everyone's searching for answers that are not going to be easily found, and they're going to have to work to find those answers, and you're not going to present the audience with. That's what I love about your movies, is that, you know, I'm happy to go watch a big action movie if it's got some certain ingredients, but I'm so much more interested in films that are about people and that are about the personal experience. And, you know, I said it in my reviews, I sort of feel like you're this modern hip version of Paul Mazursky and Woody Allen and you know, and your own voice. I mean, I don't think that you make movies quite like them, but I feel like you're interested in people, especially the way that Mazursky was. I'm not sure how much, you know, of a fan you are, you know, of his work, and you know, how much of his stuff have you seen. I'm a big fan, have been for a while. I've been revisiting a lot of his stuff over the last few weeks, and in conjunction with your stuff, I just couldn't help but feel that you're all about the element of personal connection and people coming together in unlikely ways.
I am. And most of all, I mean, I'm really interested in who am I, and our relationship with the self. And that is something that becomes really evident in our relationships with other people, because we put on masks. We have different selves that come out when, depending on who we're with, right? And what really interests me are the way that we put up these obstacles, because people want to connect with other people. That's what we want. And there aren't very many of us who can do that without a lot of angst. luckily for me, because it helps my storytelling. But that's what I find really interesting is, I mean, Hump Day is a great example. Here are these two guys who completely love each other. I mean, they have so much love and such a need to bond and to connect. They connected deeply when they were younger, and now they want to reconnect desperately. And they just keep kind of, there's just all this crazy friction and weirdness and competitiveness and shit that just comes up to kind of block them, you know, from that just really simple connection that they want to make with each other. And it's, you know, it's a different kind of obstacle that the two dudes in Effortless Brilliance, who are very different kind of characters and have a very different kind of relationship, but they're in a similar kind of bind, you know, that this one of them really wants to reconnect and the other one is sort of pushing him away. And yeah, it's just, it's, endlessly fascinating to me, how people get in the way of their own sort of inner peace and a kind of a pure, being able to just express in a pure way, you know. And yeah, but just like Touchyfeely is a great example of people who are really just trying to be comfortable in their own skin, you know, and just connect with themselves and be okay with themselves so that they then can connect with other people, you know. So yeah, it all comes back to the self, really, and who am I and where, you know, what, who am I really, and how does that contrast with who I like to think I am? That is, you know, that kind of endless question mark. And it comes up for all of us. I mean, a lot of, you know, I think most of the time we go through our lives day to day, we're not thinking of these big questions. But then there's a moment when that will give us pause and cause us to have to take stock and reflect about, you know, those bigger issues. And so those are those moments that I tend to get drawn towards. You know, there's this sort of, you know, I mean, like in Laggies, the main character has been just floating along in the current, you know, for just kind of a little bit passively letting her friends and her boyfriend just kind of tell her what she should be doing, you know, and she has bucked against it a little bit. Like, she is not in a job that she doesn't like because, yeah, well, it turns out that didn't really feel quite right to her. But this is really the moment where she stands up, you know, in that, on that river she's been floating down. She actually puts her feet down. She stands up and says, you know what? This isn't for me, you know, after all, and I'm going to get out of here, you know? And so, that is just something that I find really, really interesting.
Right. Yeah. I hope I'm saying his name right, but Josh Pais.
It's like Paisan. Think of Paisan. It's Pais.
Yeah. Awesome.
I love him. Oh my God.
He is just brilliant and touchy feely. And, you know, while watching that and everything you just said, the guy just wants to live, but he has no idea how to, and he's just crippled by his fear of living.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was such a remarkable performance and character. I just wanted to plug him real quick because I didn't when I was gushing earlier about Touchy Feely, and I think he's just, you know, absolutely fantastic. That scene where he shows up to Allison Janney's door is so heartwarming and beautiful. It's fantastic.
I got to say, putting Josh Pais and Allison Janney on screen together is one of my proudest achievements. Because, oh my God, the day that we shot, we totally improvised. They had this whole idea. She's a Reiki master and she's going to give him lessons and this Reiki.
Right.
And that was all improvised. And there was just so much gold and we couldn't end up using it was just like a tip of the iceberg what we ended up using. And we put some in the deleted scenes, but we were dying of laughter on that set. It was so much fun. But I'm so glad you brought up Josh because he was somebody that I became literally sort of obsessed by. It was the first time I really noticed him actually was in Mike White's movie, The Year of the Dog. Have you guys seen that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
I have not.
He plays Molly Shannon's boss, and he's just, I was like, who is this man? He is genius.
He's a singular. Yeah, he's the guy that comes in. I mean, every time you see this actor, and for people who don't know Josh Pais, look him up online and you'll know the face.
Yeah.
He constantly kills it in everything that he's in.
Yeah, he's remarkable in Ray Donovan.
Actor. I mean, he's so versatile and he plays guys who are, you know, who are like, the character he plays in Touchy Feely is really has no, you know, filled with self-doubt, has no self-confidence, is near, you know, a little Asperger's maybe, you know. And then he also plays like complete egotistical, crazy megalomaniac. You know, he'll do it and everything in between. Like he plays every ethnicity. he's completely versatile. I once saw a reel where they just showed all these different kinds of, and I just was blown away. I couldn't believe all the parts. But he's always so emotionally truthful. And we happened to meet. It was really like we just totally sort of luckily got to meet, and I kind of gushed all over him, and then he found out that, and he was very gracious, you know, and let me sort of geek out on him. And then he found out that I was the director of Hump Day, which he had just seen, and he completely geeked out on me. And then we were just like, okay, we have to work together. And for like 2 years, we tried to think of a thing to work together on. And then when I started writing this, I knew for sure I wrote that part for him, and I wrote Rose's part for her, and all the other parts ended up kind of falling in. You know, I was able to fill in. Allison Janney was, her part was originally going to be Catherine Keener, and then she had to drop out, but she hooked me up with Allison and said, oh, Al, this isn't a lateral step. This is a step up. She's going to be even better, you know? And of course that was amazing. And, but everybody in that film, I felt so blessed to get to work with, but Josh is a national treasure.
Yeah. And one of the things you notice too in your films is that you've gotten a chance to work with some of the same people multiple times, which is, I would have to say, a testament to the respect that people have for you and vice versa, and they want to be involved with your films. I find it remarkable that you've worked with the same cinematographer. I just wanted to bring this up because I feel like that Brad's work, how do you say his last name?
Ben Kosolsky.
Ben Kosolsky. His work has been so interesting to watch over the trajectory of your career, because you started off with a very sort of rough, you know, not in a bad way, but a rough around the edges aesthetic and a more experimental vibe in your first couple of films. And they've progressively gotten more polished, a little more refined, but they still have that off the cuff feeling. And I think it's awesome that you've had such a great working relationship with your cinematographer. And I love when directors and cinematographers pair up for multiple films throughout a career, because you really sense that there's a strong relationship there. And I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of his work. And again, I think it speaks more, you know, to you and to your sensibilities about making movies with people that you want to talk to.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to work with Ben again and again. And it's really, there are a number of people who I've been able to work with that way on a lot of either all or most of my films. My last few films, I've worked with John Labb and the same production designer. I worked for many years with a sound designer, Vinnie Smith, and he ended up becoming my composer. He started out as my boom operator in my first film and then ended up becoming expanding his role and his creative role in my movies. And to evolve together, you know, that's what I was saying when I made my first feature, it felt like, okay, it's all become about relationship. It's all become about, you know, the kind of director I love to be, my sort of highest ideal. And when I feel like I'm at my best and my work is at my best is when, or my work is at its best is when I'm a curator of all of this beautiful team of people and all these talents. And I'm able to kind of, you know, create this container for them to work, to do their best work. You know, we have a very, I always want to have a really emotionally safe set and a very, a place where people can feel, everybody feels valued and respected, because it just brings the best out of everybody. Again, it's all selfish. You know, it all is going to add up to a better piece of art at the end, but it also a better experience. Again, you know, like somehow the civilized world, the 8-hour work day, that just passed us by. I don't know why. So we have these incredibly long days, and it's like, you know, you're in some kind of weird, artificial, silly war or something. You're in the trenches, you know, together. And it can be a very, very trying and challenging time making a movie. And so if you're not going to have a good time while you're doing it, and you're not going to be with people that, you know, love and respect you and you love and respect, and you're not going to sort of be raising the bar on each other and helping each other out, then, you know, go work in the insurance industry or something. Like, just do something else, you know, don't bother, because why would you want to torture yourself that way? So, and it's fun to work with new people, but it's really nice to be able to work, you know, have these continuing, ongoing, evolving relationships, and to all evolve together as well, you know, as artists. And sort of every time we have a new project at hand, Ben and I will do a little film festival, you know, we'll sort of say, well, what do we want to, you know, what's going to be the language of this film? Because everyone is going to be slightly different. But it is nice to hear that you feel like there's always, you know, sometimes like Laggies was like, I didn't write the script, and there were so many new things about it. I kind of wondered throughout it. is this even going to feel like one of my movies? You know, is it going to feel like it's in the same filmography, you know? So it always sort of comforts me to hear people say, oh yeah, no, it's still, you know, it's still your movie. It's still, you can still sort of, you know, anyway, I like when there seems to be some sort of through line, even as I do like to explore different territory, you know, with every movie.
Right. Well, Lynn, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been an amazing conversation.
Well, it was your pleasure.
This has been fantastic.
You guys are easy to talk to, and you're just so smart. You seem to like all my movies.
Obviously. Yeah, I'm with Nick. I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie, but I will watch every Lynn Shelton movie that comes out for the rest of my life. So, I mean, okay, but Kurt Russell was in the last one, so I'll probably check that out somewhere down the line. But that's just because I have a huge bromance for Kurt Russell. That being said,
yeah.
I mean, your films are fantastic. And, I mean, you've just been an absolute joy to talk to. This has just been great.
Oh, super fun, you guys. Thanks so much for having me on. It was my pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you.
Can't say thank you enough. Like I said at the front end, it's been awesome to, you know, sort of go on this journey over the last 6-7 years with your movies, and over the last few weeks revisiting them and, you know, really, really coming to know you as a filmmaker, and can't wait to see what you come up with next. And hopefully we see a lot more from you in the future. And also, we should also say, you also had the, and I know you got to go, but we got to say that you did an episode of Mad Men, which is awesome.
Yeah. Huge.
Yeah. My first TV job, that was kind of, it was nutty. It was crazy. Another life-changing experience. Absolutely, unbelievably wonderful from top to bottom. It was incredible. But I have to give a shout out to Matthew Weiner for giving me that opportunity, because it was my largest production. You know, I'd never worked with a union crew. I'd never worked in LA. I'd never worked on a soundstage. These things were all brand new to me. And when I came off of that job, I felt like, oh, I could direct a studio film. I could do anything now, you know? And it was,
yeah, you directed Don Draper.
Yeah, exactly. I directed. Exactly. These people that I'd been watching, you know, just was in love with the entire cast, and I got to work with them all. And it was like, yeah, I can work with Keira Knightley now. So yeah, it was an amazing, boost to work on that show, and every other TV show I've been able, I love TV directing. I've been having a really wonderful time doing that too. So I'm very grateful for those opportunities.
Yep. We were talking about your TV credits. You've done some really good TV work as well.
Yeah, really super fun. And I'm going to be doing, I probably shouldn't say. Sometimes they don't like you to say until it goes. So I get to do, I'll just say this. I get to do another drama. I did Mad Men was my first TV job, and then a whole bunch of sitcoms. And
yep.
And I finally, some drama finally wants me back. So I'm going to try. First drama, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is there any feature in the immediate future, or something that you can maybe shed a little bit of news on? Or
I can't talk about anything directly, but I you know, I have a couple of things in development, and
nice.
And one thing that I'm really hoping, yes, my is next up to bat, and I'm really hoping I can get it. It's we're trying to put it together right now. Hopefully by, you know, sometime early in 2016, because yeah, it's time for me to get back on set. It's been 2 years since I was on the set of Laggies, and that is a really long stretch for me. So I'm getting a little antsy here.
Well, good luck with everything. And thank you again for coming on the show. It was our pleasure and just a blast to talk to.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care.
See
ya. Bye.